3:30. And now Barry Norman turns from the glamour of the celluloid world to the charms of radio and to The Archers, its longest-running soap. Here's his rural ramble into an everyday story of country folk.
Well, it's been very good of you to let us take over your hotel.
It's been our privilege, hasn't it, Mr. Woolley?
Yes, I should say so.
I think you've been very generous. But as the Duke was saying, we do need all the help we can get to make this a very special year for the NSPCC.
Well, if there's anything else we can do, anything at all, you have only to get in touch.
Careful, we might take you up on that.
Oh, but you can. You must. In fact, I was saying that very thing to Gerald here a minute ago. Wasn't I, Gerald?
I've come to ask you a favour, Vicar.
Oh, yes?
I'm in a terrible mess, and yet it's my own fault. I don't blame anyone, and I'm going to face up to it. But sooner or later, my parents have got to be told, and that's just something I can't bring myself to do. And I wonder, Mr. Reeford, would you tell them? You see, I...
Yes? And what would you like me to tell them, my dear?
I'm going to have a baby.
Phil, there. What's gone wrong?
In my arms. On the way to hospital. She's dead.
Hear that? There it is again.
I heard that. I heard it.
So there you are. Boy or girl, it's arrived all right.
Is Master Jack there?
Oh, Mrs. P. What's happening? What is it? Is everything all right?
Yes. You can go and see her now and tell her how proud you are of both of them. It's a fine baby boy, 8 pounds. And you and me have got a grandson at last, Mrs. Archer.
Well,
congratulations, Jack.
Golden moments from The Archers. I remember them well. Princess Margaret acting away like a trooper, Jennifer regrettably pregnant without benefit of clergy, Grace's death, Tony's birth, an everyday story of country folk indeed. The longest running soap opera in the history of the world that began on Whit Monday 1950, an age of austerity and rationing, and perhaps a more innocent age than this one. The Archers is a national institution now, of course, part of the very fabric of the country. And it came about, as these things so often do, more or less by accident, as the result of a meeting between a bunch of Midlands farmers and Godfrey Baisley of the BBC.
It all began, really, I suppose, when I couldn't find any listeners to listen to the standard BBC type of farming programme. And in the meantime, there was this conference in Birmingham to see what country folk wanted in the way of programmes about farming and gardening and country life and what you will. And there was nothing came out of that until the farmer stood up at the back and said, well, what we farmers want is a farming Dick Barton. Well, of course, everybody burst out laughing, and that was the end of the conference.
Godfrey Baisley, however, didn't laugh. Godfrey Baisley sucked his teeth and looked thoughtful and consulted Edward J. Mason and Jeff Webb. And who better? For they were the men who wrote Dick Barton, a far from everyday story of a sort of posh secret agent and his working class henchman. Bit of a tall order, really. Dick Barton down among the cowpats and the pigswill. Not easy to imagine, but Messrs. Mason and Webb set to and cobbled up some kind of a script.
But, oh dear, what a script. It was like a sandwich. There was a bit of Dick Barton, a bit of farming, and a bit of Dick Barton, a bit of farming, and a bit more Barton out, you know.
Has the car crashed? Have Barton and Jean been injured? Has Cramer escaped? If so, where to? Instalment of Dick Barton, Special Agent.
Yes, and you'd better listen hard, because very soon you wouldn't be able to hear Dick Barton anymore, for the Archers took its place, though not until 1951, when the Archers of the previous Whit Monday had apparently, and without explanation, changed the name of their abode from Wimberton Farm to Brookfield, and Ambridge, which had originally been close to the market town of Oldchester, had moved lock, stock and barrel to some other place called Borchester. Nobody seemed to notice, though, for at last Godfrey Baseley and his writers had found the right formula.
They were brilliant writers, they really were. Well, now, they gave me their expertise, and I fed them the farming material. And they taught me how to use this basic material. And the first thing they told me, said, look, not too many characters. 8 a maximum. Of course, you can have as many others as you like, but they must only be props and scenery to be woven in and out as required. A father or a mother figure or both. Young lovers, adult lovers, a comedy character, and somebody to hate. And they taught me over the weeks how to weave this thing, how to get material that would create dramatic situations. And that was it, 2 writers only, because they did a month each, and in that month they could develop a nice story, and they hand over to the next person. And once a quarter, we went out and about into the country to look at events that were going to happen in the Archers. New ideas were coming up. And, well, in the end, it became a tremendous team job. And it was a team job. Let's have no illusions about that.
The team then, and for a very long time afterwards, consisted of the 2 writers, Godfrey Baseley, who was the editor of the programme for 21 years, and Tony Shryan, who stayed around even longer and produced it for 28 years, and whose job, particularly in the early days, included making sure all the farming bits were accurate. But it was rather more complicated than that. The team had to know about the characters as well as the country lore. Who were they? Where did they come from? What were their likes and dislikes? Right at the start, Godfrey Baseley concocted an entire family history for all the main dramatis personae, tracing their ancestry back at least as far as their grandfathers. All that, plus any salient piece of information that might crop up in one of the daily episodes, was put into what, in the course of 37 years, has become a monstrous index file, the earliest cards now yellowing nostalgically like autumn leaves. Vital stuff, though, all of it. I mean, if you invite Phil Archer out to dinner, you ought to be aware that it's no good offering him Gorgonzola cheese. Old Phil hates Gorgonzola cheese. It says so in the index file. And yet, the system isn't completely infallible, as the Archer's current producer, Liz Rigby, was obliged to admit.
Well, I think we've killed... There's a character called Mrs. Blossom who's never spoken, and she's now died 3 times. Luckily, no one's noticed that. She's not coming back anymore. She's had it.
Well, all I can say is that the last time they buried Mrs. Blossom, I hope they did it at a crossroads with a stake through her heart. We don't want her turning up again, thank you very much. Still, give or take the odd lapse, like occasionally peopling the programme with the living dead, one of the strengths of the Archers has always been its consistency, especially in its determination to stay close to the soil and reflect the true concerns of the farming community. The task of getting this right and making it realistic has fallen upon BBC Radio's former agricultural editor, Tony Parkin, who is now the programme's agricultural advisor.
I manage 4 totally mythical farms. No, 3 now, because we bankrupted one of them. But once a year, I go and spend half a day with a farm management expert, and we go through these and make sure the labour, the machinery, the cropping, the stocking is all as it should be and balances up so that we haven't got too few people to do the job or too much grass growing and nothing to eat it and so on. I mean, you've just got to do it because I think the agricultural background has got to be absolutely foolproof.
Are you doing a good job of it? Are your imaginary farms making a profit?
They're all keeping their heads above water. We were slightly worried about Joe Grundy and whether he could possibly be keeping his head above water in the present economic circumstances. And I went through his farm quite carefully with this farm management chap. We came to the conclusion he would probably be one of the people who survived whatever happened, mainly because the bank won't lend him any money. They'd only lend him 5,000, you see, and the farmers who are getting into real difficulties nowadays, like Mike Tucker, who went bankrupt, are the ones who got overborrowed.
In its early days, the Archers was often accused of being a sort of propaganda outlet for the Ministry of Agriculture. And in a way, perhaps it was. But this is no longer so. It is, inevitably, still a target for every kind of agricultural pressure group. But nowadays, even when the programme succumbs to such urgent blandishments, the result is not always what the pressure group might have desired, as Tony Parkin explained.
I was bearded for years to put an agricultural secretary in the Archers, and it seemed not an unreasonable things, so eventually we did. And to cut a long story short, one Friday afternoon, she comes to Tony Archer, who was single in those days, and he's quite fancies her and has pulled the sofa up around the fire, and she makes a beeline for the sofa, and Tony bleats, well, what about the books? And she says, oh, beggar the books. And da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. I never heard from the Agricultural Secretaries Association again.
Dum-de-dum-de-dum-de-dum indeed. What can they have been doing on that sofa? Well, never mind, let's leave them to it and turn our attentions to some of the cast, paramount among them, certainly by virtue of seniority, being Norman Painting, who's been Phil Archer since day one and thus has the enviable record of playing the longest-running role of all time. Well, I say it's an enviable record, but I wondered if he thought so too, or did he sometimes have doubts about having taken it on in the first place?
At the moment, and I suppose forever, I shall be very, very glad. But it'd be less than honest to say that there have been times when I wonder whether it wasn't all a terrible mistake.
Well, yes, I can understand that, but is that because you identify with the character a lot, or because Phil Archer got in the way of Norman Painting's career in other areas?
Yeah, I don't identify with the character, I think it's true to say, really, at all, except when I'm working, when I'm in the studio. And I've always said I hang him up in the cloakroom and leave him there till I go back into the studio. And I wouldn't blame him personally, but I think there have been perhaps occasions when my commitment to the Archers has meant that I haven't done a lot of other things which at the time I thought I would like to have done. But I don't believe in regrets, and as things have turned out, I have none.
What is very interesting, of course, is that Phil Archer has been married twice. He's got four grown-up children. He's very nearly a grandfather. And you've never been married.
No.
So...
Well, I can't say it's cause and effect, can I? But in fact, as with the woman who played my mother, dear Gwen Berryman, for all those years, we did have sort of surrogate families given to us on a plate. And we put an awful lot of that end of oneself into the Archers. A couple of years ago, I was interviewed by somebody who was talking about the character as it then was, and I happened to say... And soon, Phil will be looking forward to having his grandchildren. And I was speaking quite naturally as an actor who played a part which has gone on through the generations. And I suppose when Phil Archer does have his grandchildren, there'll be more than just an actor's interest in them and more than just an actor's delight in the next generation.
Gets to, doesn't it, the Archers? Even a level-headed fellow like Norman Painting is not entirely unaffected. And what about Chris Gittins? He's been playing the gravelly, occasionally testy, but of course deeply lovable Walter Gabriel since 1951. It was a part he very nearly failed to get.
I was having a lot of trouble with my throat, and I didn't really want to have a go to play Walter, but they said we must have a Midland regional artist in. And at the end of the audition, I was half-hearted about it. It was a very nice day, and I'd been for a walk down Regent Street in the sun. And I came back, and they said they weren't satisfied with any of us. And so they said, well, we'll have another audition next week. And there were four of us all on the shortlist, Ernest Sefton and myself, Rupert Davis and Arthur Ridley. So anyway, they gave it to me in the finish, and it was turned 6 o'clock, and of course it was 6:45, and in a few minutes later I was in the programme straight away. My ambition was to be working when I was 85. I have to get in a wheelchair to the microphone, which is very frustrating really for one who's led an active life. But I'm still enjoying acting as Walt. Ah, well, yes, that's me old pal, me old beauties.
Doesn't say that a lot anymore, does he? Well, I don't suppose anyone but Walter ever said it. But it's the phrase that I, and I imagine every other listener, always associate with him. What he represents, of course, is your authentic, horny-handed son of toil. And when you think about it, there aren't too many of those in the Archers, most of the voices being more closely associated with old-school ties than Walter's old-school muffler. But among the rustics, his chief rival for popularity was dear old Jethro Larkin, played, after what one might term a number of false starts and other roles, by George Hart.
When I started, I did an umpire at a cricket match, the village bobby, and I did the first Tom Forrest, actually, because I remember some of the words... I was teaching some young lad to guddle a trout in the stream. Well, then I didn't do anything for many years. Godfrey Baisley rang me up in 1966 and said, could I take this more or less regular part in it? So I said, yes, thank you very much. I was actually still working in the agricultural machinery business in those days. And naturally, I had to see my directors and of the firm I worked for, and I told them what had happened. They said, yes, I could do the part whenever it cropped up, for which I was very thankful.
Alas, George Hart died recently, and Jethro Larkin died with him. A piece of cause and effect that was not quite as inevitable as you might think. After all, Chris Gittins as the second Walter Gabriel, and Gwen Berryman as Doris outlived three Dan Archers, and was on her fourth at the time of her own death. Well, the loss from natural causes of various members of the cast is bound to happen in a programme that's run for 37 years, a programme that seems now to be a permanent fixture. But it wasn't always so. There have been rough moments, along with the smooth and unthinkable, though it may appear today. There was a time when The Archers was very nearly taken off the air altogether. William Smethurst joined the programme in 1973, first as a writer, later as its producer. That was a little after the period when Ambridge and all its denizens were in danger of being cast into oblivion.
In about 1968, 69, it almost fell to pieces. If you look at the memos that were flying about, the quality of the script, the stories that were being run, it really was a disaster. Jock Gallagher, who'd just taken over in 1970 as the head of Network Radio, I think it was called, at Pebble Mill, was given a matter of 3 months to actually sort it out.
Well, Jock Gallagher was new to the job at that time, and though The Archers came into his department, he knew very little about the programme, which does rather indicate what sort of impact it was having then.
I had a bit of difficulty finding it at all, to be perfectly honest, because I had moved into this particular job from the news department, and we cynical journalists didn't associate with airy-fairy things like soap operas. Didn't even call it a soap opera then. It was just called The Archers, and The Archers then was an office somewhere in another corridor. So it was actually quite difficult to find. In fact, on the very first day that I took on the job, I thought I was privileged to have lunch in London with the managing director. And I was even more privileged when I arrived there and found that I was having lunch with him on my own. I mean, that's unheard of in the BBC, a minion to have a private lunch with the managing director. He started off the conversation in a very pleasant, affable way, asking me what I thought of a certain disc jockey. I thought, great, he's a lovely man, he's great, very good, very popular. Oh, do you think I've done the wrong thing by sacking him then? I thought, oh, hell, where do I go from here? And where I went from there was on to this man saying, now, about the Archers. I said, yes. And he said, well, I think it's probably got about 3 months left. Now, remember, I didn't really know what he was talking about. I knew it was a long-running programme, had been going on, I think, forever then. So I thought, something wrong here. So, you know, being new to the game, I simply accepted that I had 3 months to sort this thing called The Archers out. And then I went back to have a look at what The Archers was and what he was talking about. And I have to say, unusual for me to agree with managing directors, perhaps, but he was absolutely right. It was in a shocking state. Two poor writers seemed to spend their whole life doing nothing except write The Archers. And it had started a show. I mean, they had been doing it for the best part of 21 years. And you could feel the gaps in the script. Everybody was sloshing tea back and rattling cups, which I have now learned, of course, takes up a half a page of script, and I don't blame them now. But at that time, it seemed appalling. The editor had been aboard since the outset, and the producer had been aboard since the outset, and nobody else had. These were the people who ran this programme every single day of the week, and it was run by one man who was on a contract and one guy, the producer, who was on a short-term contract. It was renewed every 6 months and had been renewed every 6 months for 20 years. Couldn't believe it. So we just had to get in amongst it. I don't know whether I did a good job at the time because I wasn't competent to do any sort of job except save my job. That's what I was doing, I have to confess. But here we're talking 17 years on, and we're still as popular as it was before I took it on, because it wasn't terribly popular at that time. So something's happened. And it may well simply be that we added to the team of writers, we brought in another producer. We gave people breathing space. Mm. We let them actually do the job that they were being paid to do properly. We took them off the treadmill.
So the crisis was averted and the programme went on to ever greater glories, with guest appearances by the likes of Princess Margaret and the Duke of Westminster and the Earl of Lichfield taking Shula Archer's wedding picture for the cover of the Radio Times. No wonder the Queen Mother and the Princess of Wales are said to be avid listeners. But the Archers can't afford to sit back and rest on its own track record. It must change with the times while appearing to remain changeless. And last year, a rather significant change was made. Liz Rigby, a mere slip of a girl of 29, became the first woman to be appointed producer. How did she react when the job was offered?
When I was offered the job, I had an agonising night, all night, during which I didn't get a wink of sleep, deciding whether I wanted to do this or whether I wanted to go and work 6 months in the documentary features department of the BBC and television. In fact, I had to make a decision by the morning, and I still hadn't decided, and I walked round and round and round Regent's Park about 10 times. I thought, one more round of Regent's Park, and I'm going to have to make a decision. And because I couldn't make up my mind, I thought the answer might as well be yes. So, sort of, I'm here by default.
Do you regret that decision?
I certainly have regretted it on occasions, yes. It's just the most extraordinary job, because you are spending most of your life in a world that doesn't exist, and the line between fact and fantasy in your life becomes very, very blurred. I've been doing this job a year now, and I think most of my friends would say it's virtually impossible to have a normal conversation with me without me saying something like, well, that's just how Caroline felt when Brian did such and such a thing. And it dominates my every thought and my dreams at night. If I wake up in the night, it's always because I'm dreaming about Ambridge.
And this sounds terrible.
It's odd. It's something I couldn't do forever because, you know, I think I would end up in a mental hospital, because just over this year I have more and more and more moved into Ambridge, and it's become increasingly impossible for me to step outside of it. It's not terrible. You just have to tell yourself that you're doing it for a limited time period.
In the old days, there were just two writers. Now there's a team which includes, surprisingly perhaps, the BBC's defence correspondent Christopher Lee, an Archers fan from way back. And this, he said, was the way that writing team operated.
Well, you writing teams are four, but there are probably 7 or 8 regular writers. So what actually happens is that you turn up, say on a Tuesday, for a script meeting, 4 writers, and everybody sits around the table with the agricultural advisor, the director, the producer, the editor, etc. And you carve up the month between you. Then you go away, you do all the casting and things like that, and you settle down to write. And so there's these marvellous telephone conversations between the different writers. You write a week at a time. So supposing I'm week one, I'll be in contact with the person who's written the week before and also week two writer. And I'm saying, hey, don't do that, don't do that. I want to use that line. You can't use that scene. How far are you going to go with that? And so there has to be this tremendous dialogue. It doesn't always work, mind you.
Well, yeah, I mean, somebody's been complaining to me that you get hanging plot lines in The Archers. And she wants to know indignantly, what happened to the organ fund? I ask you, what happened to the organ fund?
Well, I didn't take it. No, that is a tremendous problem, isn't it? Yeah. I mean, I don't know what happened to the organ fund. I've asked Liz Rigby.
How long can you see The Archers continuing? You wrote a book called The Final Decade, Will We Survive the 80s? Will The Archers survive the 80s?
I think it would be unthinkable, almost, to remove The Archers, unless something totally sort of scurrilous happened to English society. It was interesting when the Duke of Edinburgh's birthday, at just before the 7 and 8 o'clock news, BBC Radio played the national anthem. Hmm? And I was talking to somebody that morning who'd heard it, and they said, when the BBC stops playing the national anthem for the Queen and Duke's and Prince Charles's birthday, then things have come to a pretty pass. And I said, a bit like taking The Archers off. And he looked at me and said, God help us, they'd never do that, surely. And I think that's right.
Well, just a couple of points there. Even Liz Rigby still doesn't know what happened to the organ fund. Though I expect it'll turn up again sometime. And then there's the horror of the idea that they might take The Archers off. But the mere suggestion of anything so frightful does bring up the question of why The Archers has remained popular for 37 years. I once asked that of one of the original writers, Edward J. Mason, and he said it was because the programme appealed to every Englishman's secret desire to own 2 acres and a cow. I think that's not a bad answer. But it's a safe bet that everyone you ask will come up with something different.
I think it's down to 2 simple elements, story and character. It's as simple as that. The characters are strong, they are well played and they are strong, and people care about them, they love them, they feel that they're members of the family. I went to a meeting the other night and this girl stood up and said, I really wish Jill Archer was my mother. And a lot of people feel that way about Jill. If you've got characters who are loved, you can't go wrong. You have to make people want to know what's going to happen in Ambridge. But the characters are the basic thing. And that's why the criticism that I've come in for, which has been the fiercest, has been for changing characters.
Are you guilty of this?
Yes. Yes, I am. I have changed some of the characters. But...
No, which ones?
Well, Brian. I changed from being a nice gentleman farmer into a complete ratfink. And he's going to get worse before he gets better. I think I have to work out what makes a character loved and make sure it's there. But I'm all for rounding them out.
Godfrey Baisley, I think, said at the very beginning that you've got to have somebody to hate in the programme. Do you go along with that?
He's so right. You've got to have someone to hate. Actually, that was missing, I felt, when I came here. There's this strange thing in soap opera. You bring the characters in. They always, when they come in, it's happened time after time, probably with Jack Woolley, so Mrs. Antrobus, the Snells. Every time you bring someone in, they're hated by definition. Listener sees himself in Ambridge. They don't like outsiders. And over the years, all the characters seem to get watered down. And I felt that had happened and that we needed somebody to hate. And my target was Brian Aldridge, because I felt he embodied everything that people love to hate about farmers. He's a cereal baron. He's extremely wealthy. At a time when other farmers are struggling, Brian is just laughing all the way to the bank. He has extramarital affairs with people that everybody like Caroline Bone, and he's not very nice to his wife. And I thought he was simply begging, just begging to be hated. And I think I can say that within the last year I have made Brian Aldridge hated.
You've already had the sort of thing that I imagine must be awfully saddening, the death of George Hart, who played Jethro. What effect does that have on everybody else, the death of one of the actors?
It has a very upsetting effect on other actors who've been in the programme a long time, for obvious reasons. As a man, he will be missed, because he really was a pleasure to work with. Mm. Jethro's death was a landmark, in a sense, for the programme. And my worry is, how do I get more country accents? Keep it a country programme.
You mean genuine country accents, not Mummerset country accents?
Precisely, precisely. I think that it's vital to the artist to have that. But it's very hard. You know, if you look at all the new characters that have been introduced over the last few years, they're not real country characters, they're not real country accents. They go back to the original founding actors of the programme. Plus, it upsets my age balance on the programme, because we've got a lot of elderly listeners. Now, obviously, they identify with the elderly characters. How do you introduce an elderly character? It's quite easy to introduce the young ones, doing it all the time. How do you introduce an elderly character and an elderly country character and imply that they've been there all this time, although you haven't actually heard them? If you talk to a farmer about the future of his farm, you ask a farmer, what are you working towards? And he's always working towards getting his farm into a really good heart for the next generation. And although I'm working in the short term to please listeners every day, I'm also very aware of the weight of tradition and my duty to the future of the programme. And in the same way that a farmer wants to pass on a farm in good heart, I want to pass on a programme that's in good heart.
And so this everyday story of country folk goes on, and probably on and on, reflecting the passing trends and fashions of the outside world while remaining ever true to itself. It has a quality that's essentially English, or what we like to think of as essentially English, a quality of sturdy reliability and steadfast values. Of course, it's just a soap opera, but it's a soap that somehow presents a portrait of a village that resembles no other village there ever was, and yet is exactly like every village there's ever been. Long may it continue. And in saying that, I merely echo the hopes of the late George Hart, who played Jethro Larkin to his dying day. I'll leave the last word with him. Goodbye.
Me and the Archers, for me, has meant a lot. I thoroughly enjoy it. I look forward to going up and doing the recordings and having a jolly good old laugh with all the rest of the cast. Well, it makes your day and it makes your life, and I hope it goes on forever.
An Everyday Story of Country Folk was presented by Barry Norman and produced by Helen Robson.